The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students Union, or CJSR.
Hello all, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. We are back live after our holiday, and we will again be taking your fascinating and insightful questions. Today, those questions will revolve around math. We'll be talking to physicist and author Aaron Santos about his new book, How Many Licks?, which will help you, yes, you, be the official math hero of your social group. But before we get to the bit where Aaron teaches us how to estimate things like how long it would take to tunnel out of prison using a spoon, or how many people are having orgasms right this very second, we'll start out with some speaking up. Naomi Baker is a longtime skeptic and founder of the Houston Skeptic Society, which can be found on meetup.com. She's a registered professional chemical engineer, has nearly 30 years of experience in the energy business, and is the technical director of a private company which specializes in natural gas processing with patents in CO2 and LNG technologies. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Naomi.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So you're here to talk about the ongoing controversy over whether to use paper or plastic bags.
Yes. A lot of people make their decisions on knee-jerk reactions.
Well, let's go through the entire process here. How is a paper bag made, start to finish?
Obviously, there's trees involved. In 1999, about 14 million trees were cut down to make a billion paper bags. They have to be dried, bark is stripped, they're pulped, they're chopped into chips, then they're heated with a lot of chemicals into a pulp. And then that extracted, and you get about 1 pound of paper pulp for every 3 pounds of wood chips that go in. And then that pulp is used to make different kinds of paper.
Okay, now, so there's different kinds of chemicals involved, and what's sort of involved in this process?
The chemicals to make the pulp are acids, hydroxides, caustics. If you're making white paper, a lot of bleach. There's a lot of residue called lignin left over, which can be used as a fuel, but it's not a very clean fuel. It's burning cellulose. You've seen pictures of logging camps, so there's a lot of big, heavy equipment that's also used. Plus, you always have the risk of runoff and the damage on the land when they're clear cut, if that happens to be the case.
Naomi, how about a plastic bag? What's the process?
Plastic bag is made from ethane, not really petroleum. It's ethane gas. It's heated with water to very high temperatures, and it converts to ethylene. The only byproduct of that is a little bit of natural gas that's burned to create the hot water and the heat. And then that ethylene's sent into other processes that can be made it into the polyethylene.
So are there any other chemicals that are used in the plastic bag process?
Not in making polyethylene,
okay.
Just ethane and water, which is actually recycled, and then the fuel to heat it.
So are those chemicals less harmful than the ones used in the paper process?
Well, considering ethane is actually a component of what you burn in your stove at home, it's pretty benign. It's very clean burning. It's just two carbon atoms. And so when it's heated to very high temperatures, it loses a hydrogen atom. I don't want to get too technical. So your byproduct is hydrogen gas, which is extremely useful in all sorts of processes.
So can we recycle plastic then?
Yes, it can be chopped up, it can be reused, it downgrades, it goes into lesser quality pipes like plastic pipe or garbage bags, those kind of things. But it is recyclable. The problem is that only about 2 or 3% of bags are recycled. About 10% of paper bags are recycled.
Okay, and this would be the same transportation costs for both paper and plastic, I would assume.
No, that's not true. Paper transportation is quite a bit heavier, and so it actually takes more trucks. It also is larger volume for a given carrying capacity, so that you have more truck miles, more weight. So it is actually more expensive to move and use.
Okay, now how about when both of these products get to a landfill?
Okay. plastic is 80% less volumeless than the paper, so it actually takes up less space. Paper takes up 4 times as much as plastic does.
But it eventually breaks down, whereas plastic does not.
Paper does decompose. If it's shredded, if it's exposed to heat and light. When they're just dumped in your garbage can and end up in the landfill and buried, they do not decompose for decades.
That's interesting, because that's not what we're led to believe.
If you actually Google paper versus plastic, you'll see quite a few comments that say that. And you've probably read stories where they've landfills and they find newspapers from the 20s and 30s that are still completely legible.
Right.
It's because in the absence of oxygen, moisture, heat, light, all those things, paper doesn't break down. The bacteria can't get to it.
So how about those images we see of the huge piles of plastic in the oceans?
That's the knee-jerk reaction. The responsible use of any kind of bag, paper, or plastic is to dispose of them and recycle them properly. Everybody's seen the pictures of the bird or the sea turtle with a bag wrapped around its neck. And so that's an emotional thing. But if you go through the math and if you look at the information, the plastic takes up less room, takes less energy to create and less energy to recycle. And it breaks down at about the same rate as a buried paper sack. The best choice is to use a cloth bag.
Right. Absolutely.
But if you're looking at an environmental impact, the best choice between paper and plastic is plastic, but then you dispose of it properly.
So now, why are we presented with the perception then, the public perception, that paper is so much better than plastic?
Trees are good and they're renewable. Plastic chokes birds, and it's made from oil, which is incarnate evil.
It's just that simple, hey?
Well, no, not that simple, but that's the perception, is plastic bags are made from oil, which isn't quite true. But if you're environmentally conscious, you know that fossil fuel burning is bad. So you're going to pick something that's a tree that you can, you know, it's an emotional thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when it takes 10 times as much water and 3 times as much fuel to produce that same bag, and the recycling rate is not that much different between the two, it's not a slam dunk. If you've ever been near a paper mill, the smell is horrible. They're worse than sewage treatment plants. I mean, it's really rank.
So
odors are pollutant too.
And that's a really good point. So you're saying this actually is a very clear-cut issue.
I think in lieu of using your own bags, that's the best issue.
Right.
Carry them around with you. But if you're trying to be environmentally conscious, the right answer is to pick a plastic bag and then dispose of it properly. Reuse it till it wears out, then take it and put it into a place that will take them off and turn them into, floor mats or whatever.
Right. Okay, now the post that was the jumping off point for this piece, the Houston Skeptic Society blog, Space City Skeptics, you posted this there. And in the comments section, the readers started talking about cloth versus disposable diapers.
Yes.
So can you just go into that?
I did a little research after the comments were posted, and what I seem to find from the consensus is that if you live in a part of the country that has scarce water but a lot of land for landfill, let's pick Nevada, it's better to use the plastic diapers. If you live in a place that has a lot of water but is crowded and does not have open landfill available, then it is better to use the cloth diapers.
And again, that's not something that we usually talk about, because is Nevada experiencing a water shortage?
I use that as an example. I'm actually not sure. But
okay.
Places that have a lot of unused, undeveloped, remote land that's not good for grazing or building on.
That's fascinating, because this is not something that we hear about all the time.
Yeah.
So the washing of diapers in a given city would actually have a larger environmental impact than the production and disposal of disposable diapers.
Yeah. And I can't, I don't have the details. I'm not as conversant on that, so I don't want to say things that aren't true, but that's
agreed.
My understanding of the situation.
Interesting. Well, that's fantastic information, Naomi. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
And you can read some of Naomi's writing at spacecityskeptics.com, where she posts as Geek Goddess. And I know there are a myriad of other great posts out there written by wonderful skeptics and skeptical groups, and we would love to have you tell us all about them. Email us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com, put speaking up in the subject line, and we'll talk about having you on the show. And we'll be right back with Aaron Santos on his new book, How Many Licks, right after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, thanks to the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still listen to the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by following the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest, and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to the stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including LP99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, CJAI 92.1 Amherst Island Radio Broadcasting Inc., and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. And I have good news. We are delighted to have been picked up by two new stations, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, and CILY, which broadcasts in Nelson, Crawford Bay, and New Denver, British Columbia. So British Columbia digs Skeptically Speaking. And as a former Vancouverite, I'd like to point out that the love is definitely not unrequited. So thank you, CIVL and CILY. We do very much appreciate your support. And that makes eight stations that air Skeptically Speaking in some form or another. And so we continue our meandering stroll towards world domination. And I believe we have a phone call. Hello, Ethan.
Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
You got a nice show here, I must say.
Thank you.
Well, I'm actually here, though, in my formal capacity as Ethan, the free-thinking historian, host of Radio Freethinker, Vancouver's number one skeptical podcast and radio show.
Oh, really?
That's right. You can find us every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, of course, on CITR 101.9 FM and on iTunes.
And what do you have to say, Ethan, our competitor for the Canadian skeptical audience?
Well, I wanted to inform you and your listeners of a skeptical challenge. On January 12th, at Skeptics in the Pub, we will be having the Western Canada Skeptical Showdown. So get a team of four and prepare for the ultimate pub quiz. Head down to your local Skeptics in the Pub on the 12th and prepare for a skeptical battle of the wits.
More than one wit?
Well, they'll be wits.
They'll be wits.
It could be more exciting than Luke Skywalker fighting Darth Vader. More amazing than the final battle in Lord of the Rings.
You know,
more
our
incredible
audience.
Than that time Carl Sagan bare-knuckle boxed Michael Shermer.
Did that happen? Because I would pay money to see that.
I think it was in the director's cut of Cosmos.
Nice.
And we shall see who is the most skeptical of the skeptics.
So Ethan, are you challenging us to a duel?
Oh, you could say that.
Well, see, I will be the quiz master for the Edmonton version of this event. So, so
as someone
I can...
who knows the answers ahead of time, then I think you must be banned from participation.
I will have to ask my team, Skeptically Speaking team, what say you?
Woo!
Yes.
Woo!
Really? Really? That was it. Really? We accept,
yeah!
Ethan. We accept. So for all of those Edmonton skeptics who will be in the area, if you want to come and participate in the Western Canadian Skeptical Pub Quiz Smackdown, we will be competing against Vancouver. So do come out Tuesday, January 12th. It's at 8:30. It'll be at the Black Dog in the basement. And the details are on the Greater Edmonton Skeptic Society Facebook page. So just search for that. And this will be a simultaneous pub quiz, so we will have Skype smack talk throughout the rounds. So
and I should mention to your listeners, if they're listening in Vancouver, the pub quiz will take place at the Railway Club at 7:30.
Perfect. So so come for the skepticism, stay for the hippie smack talk. We'll get you guys. Thanks for calling, Ethan.
No problem.
So I hope to see all of you there for that. If you're going to come out to one event run by the Greater Edmonton Skeptics Society, I would have to say it should be this one. So for all of those, for all of you who are wondering about what's going on with the quest for a new Skeptically Speaking theme song, please be patient. We've received some great submissions. Great. And now we're figuring out how to choose. So by the time I get back from Science Online 2010, we'll have it all figured out. Have I mentioned Science Online? It's a science communication conference in North Carolina, and it brings together scientists, physicians, patients, educators, students, publishers, editors, bloggers, journalists, writers, web developers, programmers, and others to talk about online strategies and tools for doing science, publishing science, teaching science, and promoting the public understanding of science. I'll be on a panel titled Trust and Critical Thinking, and my fellow panelists are Stephanie Zvon of the blog Almost Diamonds, Dr. Kirsten Sanford of This Week in Science, the lovely Greg Layton of Greg Layton's blog, and PZ Myers of Pharyngula. This is going to be awesome. The panel will be webcast, so check out scienceonline2010.com for details on that. And while I'll be having what I can only assume will be a brilliant time there, Mike Harrison, the guy who's usually behind the soundboard, will be on the mic next week talking about climate science. So now on to math. Those of you who have been listening to Skeptically Speaking since we started the program back in March of 2009 may remember that we tried a math episode back in the day. And it was very apparent that I am not a math person. If that was a test, I failed. But we do have someone here today to help me get over my debilitating lack of mathiness. Aaron Santos is a physicist, author, and an occasional actor-director currently doing research at the University of Michigan. He attended MIT, where he received a Bachelor of Science in Physics, and after graduating, he taught physics and chemistry in the Boston public school system. He received his PhD in physics at Boston University while studying the kinetics of the DNA melting transition in the Klein group. He's currently studying the self-assembly of various nanoscale systems in the Glotzer group at the University of Michigan. And additionally, he's the author of the book, How Many Licks? Thanks for being here, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to be searching for Michael Shermer bare-knuckle fighting Carl Sagan on YouTube tonight.
If you do find that link, please forward it on.
I will definitely do that.
So how would you describe How Many Licks?
How Many Licks is basically in my mind, it's a fun way of showing how to do very simple math calculations just using the math that we all know, just basic addition and subtraction and multiplication.
So in the book, you actually use quite a few examples to demonstrate those.
Yes. So I think it's really it's a good skill to have if you want to be a skeptic, because estimation is a lot like science in that you can never actually prove anything, but you can certainly use it to disprove things. Like if somebody presents me with some fact that I'm skeptical about, I can just do a quick estimation of their numbers and see, well, are they very far off or are they at least in the ballpark? What the book does is it uses a lot of different examples just to kind of illustrate this point of that you can use, that anybody can pretty much calculate just about anything that they're imagining.
Now, you say something interesting right here. You mentioned skepticism a couple of times.
Yeah.
Now, are you a skeptic, sir? Because some of the examples are rather irreverent. Let's call it irreverent.
The book is written much more for a popular audience. So I think you should certainly look at some of the answers with a certain degree of skepticism. But I do consider myself a skeptic ever since I read Michael Shermer's Why People Believe Weird Things. It was a big turning point for me, I think, not just as a thinker, but just also in life.
Wonderful. That's great, because when you first agreed to come on the show, I didn't realize that. So brilliant. Because in the book, you actually mentioned things like one of your examples is, how many Eucharist wafers in Jesus? And I find that a fascinating question. You also mentioned the flying spaghetti monster. And I believe there's an anti-astrology question in there as well.
There is, yeah. The what has more of an effect on you gravitationally, the moon or your obstetrician?
So all you math phobe skeptics out there, this is your book. So, and speaking of the math phobe skeptics, why do people dislike math so much?
It's a hard question, I think, because I think a lot of it has to do with the way that math is presented. I mean, generally, you know, throughout middle school, you're just kind of given this rote way of doing math that really isn't how math is done by actual mathematicians. So a normal mathematician doing a problem usually just thinks about it more in kind of an artistic way. I mean, you have these you know, whether it be numbers or shapes or, you know, just abstract symbols. You give some rules to them, and then you just kind of play around and see what you can make out of that, and what's possible given the rules that you've set out. So I'll give you an example. Like over the holidays, I was playing Risk with my brother-in-law, who's 16, and we got to a point where we were basically just, you know, our armies were just going up against each other, and you have to roll the dice a million times to see who's going to win. So I was like, this really sucks. Let's just write a quick 10-line computer code, and that'll basically simulate it for us. So we just, you know, just simple things like that, you know, I think are much more what the way mathematicians think about things. It's much more of a game to them of just figuring out what you can do under certain constraints than it is, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, 2 × 2 = 4. You know, it's much more creative than that.
So you'd like to teach the rest of us how to think about it as a game?
Yes, that's really the whole point behind the book.
Perfect. Well, audience, if you're listening live and you have a question or a comment about why math is so misunderstood, do call us at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So it's been said that that maybe mathematicians themselves aren't that accessible, and it's not the math specifically. You know, like most of the sciences, the images are of the old crazy-haired white dude with poor social skills.
Right.
So present company accepted, of course.
I do have the crazy hair.
Oh, nice. Okay. So, is there some truth to that?
The crazy hair part or the white dude part?
Well, let's take it from both angles.
At least for me, the crazy hair is definitely true. The white dude part is true, but that's something that fortunately is changing quite a bit. There was my lab partner in undergrad said that we need more women in this lab. I'm not sure he was necessarily thinking about it in the same way that people who are looking for diversity are, but I definitely agree. I mean, it's something that I think is slowly but steadily changing in the sciences.
So how about the whole idea of, you know, poor social skills, you know, very focused on these kind of academic pursuits and maybe not so much interested in communicating that to the public?
There are definitely some scientists that are that way, but the vast majority of them are definitely not. I mean, I think that was another kind of motivation for the book, is that I wanted to show that, you know, most of the things that we think about, most of the scientists that I know anyway, think more along the lines of, you know, XKCD than they do, you know, kind of rigorous tweed jacket, pocket protector. I mean, it's not at all the standard image that you're presented if you watch just about any Hollywood movie.
Right. Well, one of the articles that I was reading before the show discussed that the highest level math research is done without any thought of real practicality. Mm-hmm. So formulas can lie around for years until someone in possibly another discipline picks it up and decides that they can do something with it. Is that correct?
Sometimes, I mean, it's hard for me to say. It's never happened to me personally, but you hear kind of anecdotes and stories about different. Actually, no, I do have an example. There was, I think even back in antiquity, the Greeks or Romans, I forget which, were postulating that you could fit if you take any shape other than just a sphere or just a ball, and any sort of shape that has flat edges, so things like pyramids or cubes, things like that, that they'll pack more densely than a sphere will. And that's up until very recently, nobody had actually shown this for these tetrahedral pyramid shapes. But our research group actually did some simulations on it, because now people are synthesizing these nanoparticles that have these tetrahedral shapes, and they have all these interesting optical properties. And people are interested, what can I make with these things? So all of a sudden you have these kind of old, mathematical theorems from, long, long time ago that are suddenly being very useful because somebody's found a reason to use it. So yeah, I guess there are real examples of that happening even right as we speak.
Well, and that's the thing, you're talking about real examples.
Yeah.
That's something that your book does, is provide, well, maybe not real examples, but at least interesting examples, which is a lot more.
Fun examples was what I was going for.
So are you worried about oversimplifying this?
I think the biggest criticism of the book has been from people who are really good at estimation already and kind of wanted something more rigorous. But that wasn't really the audience I was going for. I mean, I think you can definitely make a rigorous book, but I think by doing that, I think it's bad. Pedagogically, it's pretty bad, because you're going to alienate people that aren't as familiar and maybe have like a little bit of a math phobia. You want something that are questions that they can relate to. So, things like, if you watch the Spider-Man movie, you see him shooting out all of this web. When I saw it, the person sitting next to me was like, how much does he have to eat to make all that? I mean, and these are things that I think everybody thinks about. Doesn't matter. You don't have to be a scientist to think questions like that. But it's a way to introduce mathematical concepts that people can relate to, rather than just regular abstract math.
Well, let's talk about some of those, because you actually mentioned the Spider-Man one, which is brilliant. But something else that I thought was interesting, and it's actually quite practical. The question that you asked was, what costs more per mile, NASA's New Horizons probe or the New York subway?
Yeah.
Now, can you tell us how you would estimate something like that, first of all?
So, one of the things that I say in the book is that there are things that are useful and or interesting to estimate, and then there are things that you can just look up. So something that you want to look up is the cost of the NASA probe. You probably could estimate that, but it's just not fun to. But if you look that up on the line, it's about $650 million was the total cost of the project, and that particular probe went out to Pluto, which is about 6 billion. Kilometers away. So if you calculate the cost per mile, it's only about 11 cents, or cost per kilometer, it's only about 11 cents per kilometer. Now, if you do the same thing for, let's say you're taking the New York subway, which is, at least last time I was there, was $2 to ride the subway, and you can have, stops that are only 100 meters away from each other, you almost wonder, why are we even stopping this close? And if you calculate the cost per mile for that, so $2 divided by that distance, it's about $13 per mile, per kilometer, rather. So it's about 100 times more per distance than the NASA probe. So it just kind of puts into perspective, a lot of times people ask, why are we spending so much money on these NASA projects? But when you think about it, it's not really that much money.
Right. So I guess my question is, how do you know which variables to include in these kind of formulas?
Well, you want to start with the things that you know. So, if I'm doing a calculation for, for the Spider-Man example, let's say, I don't necessarily know how much web Spider-Man shoots out in a day. Mm-hmm. but I know, you know, roughly how long each web is. And I know maybe he needs to travel like a mile or so. So I can say, well, if this much web takes him, you know, 20 meters, then how much web is going to take him a mile? And you kind of use these things to kind of build up a pathway to the answer. It's a little bit of an art form, and there's always more than one way to solve the problem. I mean, so that's actually a good way to check, is to do the problem a couple of different ways and see if you're still getting something that's a reasonable answer.
Okay, again, audience, if you're listening live, do call in with a question at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. But please do not call in with questions that Aaron will have to calculate, because he'll have to stop talking to do it, and that does not make great radio. Okay, let's talk about another example.
Sure.
Because I mentioned it during the intro. Because sex sells, my friend. So how many people are having orgasms this very second? How would you figure that out?
I have to say that when I was preparing for this interview, I was looking over the sex problem, and right next to me was stacked all of the applications for faculty positions that I'm sending out. So I will write you back angry letters if this ends up being the reason that I don't get a job after this. But okay, so orgasms.
Thank you, sir. You are kind and generous.
You know, the sex problems are an interesting case, just because there's a lot of fluctuations. I mean, some people are having, you know, tons and tons of sex, and some people are not having any sex. Mm. And it's been my experience that if you do a problem like this in public, the people who are having lots of sex will be very vociferous about letting you know that your numbers are much too small.
Really? That happens regularly?
It has to me. I mean, it could just be the people that I hang out with.
Okay.
For whatever reason, the people who aren't having as much sex aren't as willing to talk about it as much. But
right.
for the particular orgasm problem that I do in the book, you know, you assume, you know, you want to assume that a orgasm lasts a certain amount of time. So, you know, again, it'll vary from person to person, but three seconds seems like a reasonable amount of time, depending on how lucky you are. On average, there are, you know, everything from people who are priests who are hopefully not having sex to, you know, people who, you know, are chronic nymphomaniacs that are having sex all the time. So if you're looking for a happy medium between those two extremes, you'd think that having an orgasm once a week seems like a reasonable number. So you figure, well, all right, well, that's 3 seconds out of a week. So that's about, if you do the math on that, that's about five. You get a 5 out of 1 million chance at any given time of having an orgasm. So you do that, you take that probability of having an orgasm, and then you just multiply that by the number of people currently in the world, which is, last I checked, was about 6.7 billion people. And you get a number that's about 30,000 people that are currently having an orgasm. And, you know, talking about being skeptical, this whole calculation came out of the movie Amelie, where she calculates the number of people simultaneously having an orgasm and comes up with 15. So even if you take issue with some of the approximations I've made, you know, you're probably not going to get a number as low as 15, even if you tweak the numbers quite a bit.
Okay, I have a page here of questions that people have submitted before the show. I sent this out over Twitter requesting questions, and people definitely responded.
Okay,
our audience likes math. And they also apparently like being totally inappropriate, because some of these questions, people, I am not bringing up on air. So let's start with this one. How much mass would Bruce Banner have to add to actually turn into the Hulk?
Okay, I have to say that when I did this calculation, I did it, you know, straight up, no, not looking anything up at first.
Mm-hmm.
And the picture I had in my head was of the original TV Hulk, where it's just like a guy who's painted green, and so I figured like he only maybe gains at most he's maybe 300 pounds, definitely not more than that. So for that I figured he gained about what was my number? Let me see here. at very most 200 pounds or 90 kilograms, if we're going to do it in mass. But then I was feeling a little bit nervous about that, because I remember watching the Ang Lee Hulk movie, and that guy looks like, you know, he's 30 feet tall. So I actually went on the Marvel.com website and looked up, you know, the Hulk mass, and I didn't realize this, but there are apparently three different Hulks, ranging anywhere from 900 pounds to 1,400 pounds. So if you do it for that, then you get a much larger difference. He gains about a mass of about 1,000 pounds.
Do people ask you random questions like this all the time, like on the street? I'm just wondering. Like, are you that guy?
I don't think I am well known enough to. I mean, it would be very bizarre if somebody just kind of went up to you and was like, "Hey, how much mass did Bruce Banner weigh?" I get occasionally what I'll do is I'll post on Facebook or Twitter. You know, I'm looking for problems to, you know. So I was looking to find some problems on cars, and you know, so Ed, you know, 10 to 20 emails saying, you know, calculate, you know, how much skin does Fred Flintstone lose every time he tries to stop his car? You know, things like that. So I do get occasional weird questions that people want me to answer, but almost always it's when I'm asking for them.
Well, that's good. That's good. But, you know, if your book becomes very successful, you will be that guy.
I hope so.
You react? Will you stop on the street and actually calculate these things for people?
It's hard. I mean, it's, you know, I think I love to be, I love to please people, and it would be hard to say no. I mean, I think Harrison Ford at one point had a line about, you know, if I'm something about, you know, I don't mind stopping and signing autographs, even if I'm at dinner, but if I'm in bed, I'm not going to do it. So I think it would depend on the situation, but yeah, I'll do my best for anybody who's interested enough to ask a question.
Listeners, you can look on our website and find Aaron Santos's picture. So if you see this gentleman on the street,
I don't know if I was asking for a point.
Okay, let's go on to another question. I thought this one was interesting. How long would it take to find a needle in a haystack?
This one was actually, I had a lot of fun with this one. Because the answer surprised me a little bit. So I was just on vacation with my wife's family, and they're in Nebraska. And if you drive through Nebraska, you'll see these giant hay bales that are, you know, they're kind of this cylindrical shape. They're about 6 feet tall and maybe 10 feet long. So from that, you can calculate the volume. And I figure, you know, if you're just going there and just kind of grabbing a handful of hay at a time, you know, the handful is full as a certain volume. And you can, I figure you can look through the handful in maybe like 30 seconds or so. And just dividing that handful into the total volume and then multiplying by 30 seconds for each handful, you get an answer that's about 27 days, so almost a month of no breaks, just sitting there looking for a needle in a haystack, which was much longer than I was expecting. I was thinking maybe, you know, it's not that, it's only 6 feet tall, maybe it'd take like a day. But yeah, it actually took a long time. This of course assumes that you're not doing like Mythbusters do, where they're, you know, they run the hay through, you know, a magnet, or you're you know, trying to get the hay to float and get the needle to sink down to the bottom of a pool.
Right, or blow it up.
As Mythbusters would always do.
Okay. So actually, so that expression is quite apt. You're going to lose a lot of time like that.
You would waste a lot of time.
Okay. Okay, I have another question here, and actually, people got quite technical here. Uh-huh. During the Great Flood, mm-hmm. how much rain would have to fall each day over 40 days to reach the top of Mount Sinai? And is that more or less than the recorded data on the heaviest rainfall?
Well, the answer to the second question is yes. Okay. The answer to the first question is... all right, so you take the surface area of the Earth, which you can look up pretty easy. That's just a quick Google search. And then you multiply the amount of the, what was it, Mount Sinai?
Mm-hmm.
You multiply the height of that mount, and that the it's about 2 kilometers high, and you will get the total volume which, if people don't mind me using scientific notation, is about 3 times 10 to the 16 meters cubed. So if you that gives you the total volume of water that would cover the Earth. But if you want to do a quick and dirty calculation, you can just say, well, it's about 2 kilometers high, and I have 40 days, so I'm just going to divide the 2 kilometers by 40 days, and I'll get about 60 meters a day. So to put that number into context, Seattle, which is known as the rainy city, only gets about 3.6 meters a year. So it would need to rain for about 15 to 20 years to get just what you would need in the first day of the flood.
I will use this at some point, this information. Thank you, Aaron. Okay, how about this one?
Okay.
What are the odds of finding carbon-based life on another planet?
Yes. There's a famous physics equation called the Drake equation, named after a guy named Drake, who basically said if you take the probability that a planet is a certain distance from a star, that it's, what's the probability that it's going to have oxygen? What's the probability that it's going to have, the right chemical environment? And there's all the different people who do different calculations on this equation. I hate to do this, but I'm going to take a pass on this one just because I think the best way of putting it is what XKCD did, which is they had a great comic with just showing the Drake equation and all the variables that go into it, and one more variable that was basically how much BS you're willing to put up with from Professor Drake.
Right. I see where you're going with this.
Yeah, I think to be a healthy skeptic, I don't think I could answer that question with any reasonable degree of confidence. I think there's way too many assumptions in that one.
Okay, well, here's one with that I thought of myself.
Okay.
Which has lots of information. So if the Skeptically Speaking team got locked in the on-air booth, which used to be a bank vault,
yep,
and we'll assume that it's airtight when the door is closed,
mm-hmm.
How long would it take for us to run out of air? And so we have 5 people in the booth every show,
mm-hmm.
And the booth is about 10 feet by 6 feet.
Okay, and I'm going to assume that you have about a 10-foot ceiling. So you can calculate the volume of the room, and if you remember your high school chemistry, you can use the density of the air and the molecular weight of, let's say, nitrogen to calculate roughly how many molecules you have in the air. And from that, you can calculate the... you can look up the fraction of oxygen molecules, which I assume is what you're talking about, because you're not technically going to run out of air. The air will still be there. It'll just have much less oxygen in it.
Right.
But you can calculate the number of oxygen molecules that you have. It turns out that this is another one of those things that you can feel free to look up. But each time you breathe in oxygen, you lose about 25% of it. 25% of it gets converted to carbon dioxide. So if you... So you have your total amount of oxygen that you need to lose. So then it's just a question of figuring out, well, how much oxygen do I lose per second? Well, you have 5 people in there, so that's 5 times as much as one person, obviously. And each person's lungs have about 5,000 centimeters cubed of volume in total that they're sucking in air with. And if you're using all that volume, and let's say you're taking breaths... once every 3 seconds, you can calculate how quickly you're using up that oxygen. So you just have to divide the total amount of oxygen that you have to do by the rate at which you're sucking up that oxygen. And if you do that, and assuming my math is correct, I got you guys living for about 2.5 hours.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, so not very
wow.
long at all. So... Don't make any sudden movements. Don't jump up and down. Just sit there and barely breathe.
I would like to point out that since this was a bank vault, you sort of get a bit of vacuum pressure sometimes, and sometimes people get stuck inside it. So we don't close the studio door all the way. So if there are any other programmers, CGSR programmers listening, you have 2.5 hours. You're welcome. So, another interesting question from the website.
Okay.
How many hours of porn does the average U.S. male watch in a year? And a related question, how many fights does the average couple get into a year?
Okay, so, right, sex sells. so the porn question, again, this is one of those ones where I think it's a little bit of a sensitive issue for some people. And so I always like to make sure that for things that might be a little controversial, I double check my numbers. But I couldn't today because I was doing all of these calculations last minute at work. And, you know, I'm pretty sure if I were to, you know, try to look up something that was like, you know, porn into my Google search, my computer would have gotten flagged pretty quickly. So I have no way of supporting this data. But I did take a quick survey of different people and got some numbers that seemed like they should be pretty standard. But so let's see. Let's use some upper and lower bounds. So, you know, there are some people that are going to watch porn 10 hours a day. You know, that's not what people are going to do on average. There are some people who are not going to watch any porn at all. So I think probably a safe number is something in between those, which is just going to be about maybe one hour a week, let's say. You know, it seems to within an order of magnitude, it seems like something that's a reasonable estimate. And if you do, you know, 1 hour a week, that's just going to be 52 hours a year. That one's actually really, really, really easy calculation to do. Now, the related question about marriage fights per year, which I'm going to treat as independent of the pornography question.
I would as well.
Yeah, I think if you again, it's going to depend a lot on what sort of relationship you have. I've been in relationships where, you know, you're fighting at least three times a day. Those relationships don't tend to last long. You know, so I think, you know, my wife and I right now have a very good relationship. We don't fight very much. But I think, you know, using myself as kind of a lower bound and, you know, the three times a day as an upper bound, I think, you know, maybe once a week or once a month is probably good. Let's say once a week, because you know it also depends a little bit on how, you know, how strictly you're defining fighting. Are we talking, you know, dishes flying off the shelves and shattering on the wall, or are we talking, you know, you forgot to put the toothpaste cap back on, which also inevitably could lead to, you know, dishes crashing against the wall, but. You know, let's assume once per week. So again, you know, roughly 50 times per year, I would say, you know, is a reasonable estimate for that. You know, assuming you have a reasonably good relationship. But then again, you know, 50% of marriages end in divorce, so it could be a lot higher.
Now, this is interesting. You say that you didn't look up information on porn and such at work, but for a Fermi problem, isn't that sort of the game? Is to not look anything up?
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is that you can calculate it just about anything, but occasionally you want I mean, it's just like science. If you want, you know, it's good to have one bit of evidence suggesting something, but you always want to back that up with you know, more sound evidence, more ways of confirming that you know you're not way off the mark. So it's always good just to double check.
And on that note, we're going to go to a brief break, and we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking to Dr. Sanchez Azofaifa, Director of the Center for Earth Observation Sciences, Professor of the Earth and Atmospheric Sciences Department at the University of Alberta, and a Principal Investigator of the TropiDry Collaborative Research Network, about climate change, the science and research behind current theories, and some of the criticisms of them. Science and Global Warming. Next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. MST, live on CJSR and at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're here with Aaron Santos, physicist and author, and we're talking about his book, How Many Licks? So let's keep with the relationship theme here. Very cute question. I met my girlfriend online, and she's totally the one, but she lives on the other side of the continent. I've been wondering about the odds, not just that we would meet, but that we'd both be born at this time in history when the internet exists and allows us to interact over such a large distance.
This is actually a pretty interesting question, because I had considered a very similar problem, which was just, you know, what's the probability of finding Mr. Right, assuming that there's only one person that's right for you in the world. But this particular question is interesting because of the, you know, what was the chances that we were born in the same time in history?
Mm-hmm.
So this is another one where I needed a little bit of help. So I know that there's roughly 6.7 billion people now, and I know that, you know, people go back to about 70,000 BC. But how, you know, but the population has been growing ever since then. So I went on Wikipedia, I looked up human population growth, and this is probably more advanced than something I'd want to put in a beginner's book, but I did just a quick calculation of how many, you know, they do the different populations at different times in history, and just to calculate how many, so I just did a quick calculation of how many people have been born throughout history. And the interesting thing that I found was that if you take that number and divide into it the 6.7 billion people that are alive today, the number I got was that of all the people that have ever lived, 30% are living today, which seemed much too high. But I actually went and you know, again, you whenever you get a number that you should be a little bit skeptical about, you want to go back and check it. And So I looked up online to see if anybody else had done a similar calculation, and it turned out that they had, and they had done something that was around 6%. So I was off by about a factor of 5 from what they had, but still reasonably close. But it's amazing when you think about it. When you think we've been around for, you know, 70,000 years, how, you know, that you know, anywhere from 5 to 30% of people are still living. It's pretty amazing. But anyway, the probability of finding Mr. Right, if you're not taking into account history, at least what I find in the book is about 1 in 200,000. But if you take into account that you might not have necessarily been born at the same time in history, maybe you have that. I forget the movie. I think it's Sandra Bullock, where it's like there's like a mailbox or something, and there's like a time warp. But a better example is the Christopher Reeve movie, where he goes back in time and finds the love of his life. But if you take into account this idea that you might not necessarily have been born in the same time period, then you have to multiply the 1 out of 200,000 by about 0.3, assuming that we have that 30% of the people are born at this time period. So it's a pretty interesting calculation. It also explains, I think, a little bit why people are spending so much on dating sites and. You know, because the odds are not very good if you're looking for that one Mr. or Mrs. Right.
Right. So let's, you know, we started out this entire episode talking about paper versus plastic and recycling and such. Mm-hmm. So let's end it in the same way.
Okay.
The last question is also from the website, and I'm sorry everybody who sent in questions. We would have gotten two more, but maybe we can figure this out. Maybe you can send them to Aaron to figure out. But how many gallons of ketchup get wasted every year in those little foil packets that get thrown in the garbage when you empty your tray?
Right. I was actually just watching a video online of if you're interested in something that you can do with ketchup packets. Everybody wants to explode them, but there's a video online of a very skinny weightlifter dropping about 200 pounds on like 100 ketchup packets and watching them explode. So you know, put that on your YouTube request for tonight, along with Carl Sagan versus Michael Shermer in a grudge match. But all right, so the ketchup problem is it was a little hard for me because I try not to go to fast food quite so much, so I didn't have a really good estimate for how often I get ketchup packets. But let's assume that the average person gets fast food once a week. I figure once a month is probably seems like it's too small. Once a day seems like it's much too frequent. So
yeah.
once a week sounds like a good amount.
Okay.
And usually I don't know why they always put two, but they always put two on your tray. So that's two ketchups per tray, one fast food visiting a week, and there's 50 weeks a year and 300 million people, let's say, in the United States. So What you'll get is, let me see, what did I get? I also got about 5 centimeters cubed per packet, and then that gives you a number of about 15 million gallons when you do out all the math. So putting that into context, if I were to spread that out over 1 mile by 1 mile area, it would be about an inch thick of ketchup a mile by a mile that gets tossed out every year by people in tossing away their garbage.
Ew. thank you, Aaron.
These were fun questions. Your listeners definitely know how to ask a good Fermi question.
Oh, good, good. You hear that, people? Well done. And that's it for our time today. Thank you so much for being here, Aaron. That was great.
It was an honor, and I've had a great time.
And you can find Aaron's website at aaronsantos.com. And you can also follow him on Twitter at Aaron T. Santos. And you can find our website, as usual, at skepticallyspeaking.com. And from there, you can friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or subscribe to the show in iTunes. Thanks for listening, and everyone else, we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government. And everything you believe is a lie.
Everything you believe is a lie.